On behalf of LSE Cities, good evening and welcome to this really exciting event with Diane Davis and Alejandro Echeverri, which will be looking at political strategies and tactics for transformative urban change. My name is Philip Rode. I'm the Executive Director of LSE Cities, which I run with my colleague Ricky Burdett. And we are hosting this event as part of our regular public lecture series, but also as part of this week's Executive Masters, of which we have about 22 colleagues in the room. And that group is investigating this week issues of urban strategy. So this is a great opportunity to reflect further on questions of proactive intervention in cities and to test some of our basic ideas about how accelerated and transformative change in cities can be achieved. Now, before introducing our guests and then handing over to them, I'll make a few opening remarks, introduce also the structure of tonight, and then hand over, as I said. Now, the overall focus, and this is actually quite important, rather than once again unpacking big questions of substantive issues of strategies, the what we want to achieve, we are really transitioning tonight into how we get from A to B. So it is a question of really facilitating strategies that can deliver preconceived ideas. Now then there's the strong emphasis, as you can see it here, on strategies and tactics. Now rather intriguingly, it doesn't happen that often that we're actually juxtaposing these two terms, and possibly in the future that's about to change. So allow me to very briefly dwell on those two terms, and we'll then come back to both throughout the rest of the evening. Now both terms have their roots in military operations, but equally have been adopted to mainstream policy making for some time. What's interesting, if you were to look up academic publishing around tactics and urban, you very quickly end up with indeed military-related research. So something seems to be hanging in there around the tactics question. There are a whole range of different interpretations of how you juxtapose strategies on the one hand and tactics on the other. They can be seen as opposite ends. Strategy assumes power, and tactics could take advantage of unpredictable changes and may be led by the non-powerful. That's one way of seeing it. If you come from urban studies, you may wonder whether the strategy versus tactics issue is just a reheating and rewarming up of the debates about long-term planning on the one hand and incrementalism on the other, or design versus evolution. But then there are others who actually would argue this is a sequential relationship where strategies, the definition of what you actually want to achieve in the long run, come first and are then followed up by the how you get it done, i.e. the tactical approach to policy and also to design. Now, in urban planning, what's really interesting is that strategy is such a long-standing term, endless amount of publishing about it, but also practice. Just think of strategic planning. This has been with us for some time. That's not the case with tactics. It's really a term which feels maybe a bit more novel to those of us that have been in the space of urban policy making and urban governance for some time, but it's certainly gaining traction more recently. Now, tonight we are going to also in some ways contrast two interpretations of tactics, and our speakers very much represent these different schools of thinking and doing. On the one hand, there are design tactics, and on the other, there are political or policy tactics. Design tactics may make more sense of particular spatial opportunities that open up. More recently, we have heard increasingly this term being used around tactical urbanism, around the work of Mike Lydon out of New York, short-term action, long-term change, intervention beyond the state, collaborative, community-led, pop-ups, temporary interventions, but also activism and subversive approaches come to mind. By contrast, policy tactics seem to really be concerned about windows of opportunity, appropriate timing for pursuing a certain agenda. They're both temporal and spatial. They, of course, also see spatial opportunities as an important contribution. It's about communicating co-benefits. So you may have an agenda around carbon, but you don't get anywhere because no one is really excited around that theme. So you talk about health, or you talk about things people really inherently care about. The importance of demonstration projects is another good example of tactics which then help us to get our policy goals being achieved. Now, Diane's work on urban transport is an exemplary example of really exploring the urban policy approach to tactics, and her most recent book, I highly recommend it, tries to understand what we can learn from a range of empirical cases. Now, the structure of tonight, we have two presentations, relatively short, 20 minutes each, where we will hear about these different experiences from Diane and Alejandro. We then have a 20-minute panel conversation, and then, if time allows, 25-minute for Q&A. You have a Twitter handle, LSE Urban Tactics, which I hope you will be able to use. So let me introduce Diane first, and then Alejandro. Diane Davis is the Charles Dyer Norton Professor of Regional Planning and Urbanism and Chair of the Department of Urban Planning and Design at the Graduate School of Design at Harvard University. Trained as a sociologist, Diane's research interests include the relationships between urbanization and national development, comparative urban governance, socio-spatial practice in conflict cities, urban violence, and new territorial manifestations of sovereignty. Before moving to the GSD in 2011, Diane served as the head of the International Development Group in the Department of Urban Studies and Planning at MIT, where she also had a term as the Associate Dean of the School of Architecture and Planning. Now, I had the pleasure to engage with Diane really on a subject in some ways where she has come full circle. She started her work, I think, as a sociologist on transport policy, and I think it's delighted to see you re-engaging with that subject. Now, Alejandro is going to be our second speaker. He is an architect and planner from Medellin in Colombia, co-founder and director of URBAM, the Center for Urban and Environmental Studies at IAFIT University, and formerly the director of urban projects at the municipality of Medellin, which is not just any city, it's the most innovative city in the world, and the period of 2005 and 2008 are often credited as the core period of innovation, and it was that moment where we, I hope, we'll hear more reflections from Alejandro about. Now, he earned the National Architecture Award in 1996, the National Urban Planning Award in 2008, the Curry Stone Design Prize in 2009, and many others. He was also Loeb Fellow at Harvard University, and I think can be credited for really making offering a reinterpretation around equity planning under this banner of social urbanism. So I'm really looking forward to two fantastic speakers tonight, and ask now Diane to open this up. And please join me in welcoming Diane Davis.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you, Philip. Thank you, Ricky, and others at the LSE. I'm glad, I kind of am free riding on your on a week that I know Alejandro was going to be here, but I'm very excited to be here and share some of my ideas about political strategies and tactics. I do want to say that it's a special honor to be with Alejandro, who is kind of a major urban designer who is known for his tactical urbanism and has created so many wonderful changes in Medellin and other cities around the world. And I was going to say a little bit more about the parallel between the design tactics and the political strategies and tactics, but Philip did a wonderful job in making the introduction, so I'm just going to kind of get straight to my project. Let me just say that I'm going to try to keep my 20 minutes focused on a research project, Philip, nicely, and I have some flyers, showed our book, and flyers with a 30% off, Oxford University I have some great friends out in the audience, my urban Latin American friends. I see many of you here know my work on kind of urban political economy. You might be surprised that I kind of am teetering into the transport policy world. I'm not a transport policy geek, but I've really been involved in a project for the last 4 years that's been funded by the Volvo Research and Educational Foundation on the role of politics, or what I'll be saying, the political strategies and tactics and governance in the creation of transformative, sustainable practices in transportation across the world. So the project I wanted to say, and this again harkens back to the framing that Philip has given for us today, is that project was funded by an organization that has funded many what they call centers of excellence around the world that study what are the transportation innovations and changes that need to be introduced to make cities more sustainable. And at a certain, after years of funding millions of dollars of of centers around the world in the VREF, which is their shorthand for the Volvo Research and Education Foundation, they started coming to the conclusion that everybody knew what needed to be done. And the question was, how can you get something done? So this project, which started in 2014, actually was explicitly intended to focus on the politics of what we were calling transformative urban transport. And it was called TUTPOL, so Transforming Urban Transport, the Role of Political Leadership. Now, the first thing that I want to say is that very soon when we got into the project, we studied 8 cities around the world, and there is one of the cases on Mexico City, so my friends here know that I work on Mexico City, know that we're looking at Latin America as we're going to hear more about from Alejandro. But one of the points of this project was to think more generally whether there's such a thing as common knowledge that can be generated from case study analysis of 8 cities in very different developmental governance contexts. And as somebody who has spent her life going deep into the politics and history of one particular city, which is Mexico City, this was something totally new for me. And I actually did not think that we were going to be finding some general principles about what needs to be done in terms of politics, strategies, and tactics, or even that would transcend different governance arrangements. Because these are very different types of governance arrangements. Some are on a spectrum. And I do want to mention that in our cases, there was a restriction with Volvo to look at democratically governed cities because they were working under the impression that they didn't want to look at how things got done in a place like China, for example, because they just thought it was like straight down, top-down decision making. This was a bit of a constraint. So these countries are like on a spectrum on where they stand with respect to how deep democracy is. But more importantly, from my perspective, they have very different governance arrangements. Some are more decentralized, some are centralized, some are in a federal system, some in a more centralized system, as in like the French case, etc. So we looked at all these 8 cities and tried to look at what we thought were some of the most sought after urban transport innovations, and they're described right there. So we also looked at very different transport policies. We were more interested in the lessons about strategies and tactics and not any particular transport policy. I understand if there are any methodological experts here, there are strengths and weaknesses with this kind of a case study analysis. It was really deep case study. We interviewed, we went, and we had teams in those cities working with local researchers over a couple years to come up with what we found were some general principles across all these different cases that seemed to make a difference. And I actually was surprised at the findings, and that's what I'm going to be summarizing with you today. And it's clear that we're talking about, and maybe we'll hear more from Alejandro, not only like hardware, big infrastructure policies, but also what I might call software, use of IT to kind of advance sustainability, as well as like changes in pedestrians. So for example, in the New York City case, Jeanette Siddiquam was very focused on the transformation of downtown streets. So there are a variety of sets of things that we put under the category of transport, access, mobility that we studied and looked for generalizations. So we came up, and already Philip has given a few ways, so I'm not going to take all my 20 minutes, but I want to share with you, without too much detail, what were the technical politics that we identified in all these cases. This is what they are: timing, how you strategically frame the issues, how you engage stakeholders, assess and what we say enable, in other words, how you anticipate opposition or resistance, how you use technical experts in the political process, and how you basically understand who is going to be undermining your policy and how do you kind of deal with that opposition. That's the last point about proactively assess policy responses. But what I want to do is like say a little more about those 5 strategies and those 5 tactics with 2 of the cases. And I did not choose one of the Latin American cases. I'm going to say a little something about Seoul and Paris, which are very different political systems, and both of which we found some of the very similar strategies and tactics. So, for example, in Seoul, what we were looking at was essentially an entire restructuring of the transportation system that in some senses was triggered by the collapse of a bridge, the Han Bridge, that brought lots of environmental activists into the picture who had also been mobilized, if anybody, well, urban design, I know Alejandro knows this, mobilized around the Chongqing River restoration, the restoration of the Chongqing stream. So basically, there was, and this was a moment of transition in the early 2000s when South Korea was moving to become a much, what was democratizing, although the mayor in the period that we looked at, MB Lee, who I think is in jail now for corruption, the mayor that we looked at was identified with the conservative authoritarian party, but was democratically elected the mayor of Seoul. I want to say one other thing, which is not in my PowerPoint, but maybe we can talk about it later. In all of our cases, mayors are absolutely central in the kind of assemblage of actors to get things done, which isn't to say that you can only get things done if a mayor wants it. Mayors have to engage a series of allies, both within the public sector and outside the public sector, to get something done. But I think that is super important. And again, I want to frame that by saying when we started this project, Volvo maybe thought we were going to identify like individual characteristics of mayors, how charismatic they were. You know, they had these ideas of the Bloombergs of the world, etc. But in the case of New York, which I'm not talking about, you heard me mention Jeanette Sadiq Khan. It was not necessarily the mayor who was the most important person in the constellation or the assemblage of actors, but in all of the cases that we looked at, if the mayor wasn't enabled and empowered or willing to work with whoever were the movers and the shakers in the system, it wasn't going to happen. And those things happen in different ways. So the exactly what we call an availability of solution. MB Lee went and visited. He went to Curitiba. He went all over the world to look for the latest ideas in transportation and bring them back. He introduced a version of the bus rapid transit. He tore down highways, and he offered a new integrated bus system where the bus system was integrated with the subway. I'm not going to give all the details, but it was probably one of the most comprehensive kind of transport changes that we looked at in all our cases. And we might say maybe that's a residue of a more authoritarian governance structures that allowed them to do 6 or 7 or 8 different things. But it was not just that. It was the fact that MB Lee was very proactive in holding meetings, in working with opponents, strategy and tactics, even before he was elected mayor. He had a strategy and a plan before he was elected. So, and the second point I wanted to make about that Lee was super smart about is that even though my analysis as an urban political economist, and I was dealing with more transport people and more governance people in this project, I saw things differently than the transport folks in our project. To me, it was pretty obvious that these kind of changes that he was pushing were all about real estate development on the other side of the Chongqing River. But he was very astute in framing the discussion, both in public and in private, about everything else but that. And this is, you mentioned that, about how you talk about something. So sometimes, if you want to, you know, change transport to advance sustainability, the last thing you want to do is talk about transport. You might want to talk about environment. You might want to talk about, well, that's the second one, the restoring a stream, the Chongqing stream, the kind of new identity of Seoul in the new democratic period, etc. So it was kind of a combination of different goals besides transportation that were behind the agenda and how he framed it. He was very smart in having backroom meetings. In our book, we talk a little bit about the kind of front stage and backstage. There are public meetings, but also the private meetings. Some things never get to the public meeting and stay in the private meeting. But he also was able to bring bus drivers into his project. Cost him some money, but he basically, this is what we may recruit and enabled allies, people that alternatively might have lost something from this transport policy were brought into the benefits of it. He also created a new agency within the public sector just to do technical analysis. that was in a way a bunch of technocrats, but technocrats that were not actually making the political decisions, that had parallel conversations going on between the technical experts and the mayor and his elected team. And of all the places that we looked at, I would say, except for maybe Stockholm, and we said congestion charging in Stockholm, that this kind of sophistication of this kind of think tank, public sector think tank about transportation, was extremely important. Another point I want to make, and I think Philip has underscored this, that what almost all of our cases use prototypes and trials. Very few of the cities actually changed their policy or changed their laws immediately. They started with a prototype or a trial. And in the case of Seoul, he started a prototype with the new bus line, and people were extremely unhappy, and he went back to the drawing board. There were protests, etc. So thinking a little bit more about that allows you to understand what the opposition would be, and if you don't, if you can't anticipate in advance, prototypes are ways to kind of bring those people to the table. And then, of course, financing becomes very important. I need not say that to anybody here. But in some senses, in order to get the whole system to work, he brought in the private sector to offer a smart card that allowed kind of costs being shared across four or five modes at the same time. It's extremely difficult to do. Sometimes you have unions or other organizations that don't like talk across transport modes, but they were able to do this with a financial card that allowed the benefits to be distributed equally. In other words, if you were doing one leg of it, there was an accounting of that and you got compensated for that, whether you are a bus driver, a taxi driver, subway, etc. So the second case I want to share really in my last like 8 minutes is Paris. So Paris is, of course, a very different political system, where the city of Paris, this is happening in the context of a political system where there's a huge amount of centralization. Obviously, Paris and many of our cities, it wasn't done purposefully, but many of our cities are capital cities, which may be something also we can talk about, because that adds a veneer of kind of politics to things which can enable as well as constrain innovation in transportation. But in Paris, there were a series of decentralization reforms that occurred in the period of the 90s and 2000s. And I want to say that like our work was undertaken in 2014. We were looking at, in each one of these cases, we were looking back at different temporalities. In the Stockholm case, which I worked on directly, we went back to the 80s and 90s. Remember, that's the congestion charging, to look at road charging. But for example, in Mexico City, which I also helped with since it's an area that I know quite well, we went back to the López Obrador administration in 2000. It took 12 years to get three lines of bus rapid transit. So some of these took quite a long period of time to kind of push towards the innovation that we examined. And some were much more rapid, as in the case of Uber, which unfortunately I'm not talking about today, but if you want to come to the Greater London Council tomorrow night, we're going to be talking about IT technology and transformation of transportation. So, but back, I want to go quickly through Paris. There were a series, and it's all in the case studies, but a series of political mobilizations with the Green Party that created a fissure between the conservatives and the more the left and, shall we say, the right. In Paris, there was a general strike. There were questions about the centralization of the government under Sarkozy. And, of course, as anybody knows, in Paris, there's a huge problem of real estate development and the fact that there's no integration between the suburbs and the city. And one of the things we were looking at, not just the Paris 2020 vision, but the ways in which transportation became both cause and effect of a new way of understanding the integration of the center and the periphery of Paris. So in Paris, the case, it wasn't really talking about transportation or even necessarily urban connectivity, which was kind of complicated in the case of the regions in the center, because around the city of Paris, you've got mayors from different political parties with very different political agendas. So in this particular case, it wasn't the same framing as the Seoul case, but it was a framing that was appropriate to the political mobilizations and the sense of citizen dissatisfaction at hand. Whereas in Seoul it was environmental and economic goals, in Paris it was environmental and social goals. And again, I'm these just a little more information about the ways in which opposition was undermined, the ways in which the city of Paris worked with Velib and Bikes, etc., to kind of create a public-private partnership around change that allowed the government to be able to look like it was pushing back against the national government, as well as generating new opportunities for alliances with the suburbs of Paris. I think in the point about technical expertise, we found in several of our cases, including the Los Angeles case where we looked at a referendum, and actually LA is a super interesting example because this was the only case of all of our cases where any major change in transportation had to be approved by referendum, which meant 65% of the population had to vote for it. This is an almost impossible barrier to be kind of surpassed if you think about what you're trying to do in cities around the world to actually have the public vote on that. But they were able actually to do that by working with bus riders, unions, et cetera. But in all those places, there was a lot of use of polling technology, et cetera, to constantly, you know, take the temperature of what people were thinking or not thinking about how likely it was that advocates for transportation change were going to be able to push their agenda through. This proactively, what we're calling proactively assessed policy responses, is really a matter of understanding how do we get more people excited about the larger domain. In this case, it's about the social transformation of the city, the more environmentalism, taking cars off streets, enhancing pedestrian and everyday life, and being able to finance all those changes in kind of street life. So, my last two slides. What I want to say that, and maybe we can talk, after we talk a little more about the difference between kind of design strategies or design tactics and how they help us understand interventions and compare them with political tactics. One of the things that we asked ourselves at the end of this project of looking at these different eight case studies, or at least I asked, and I developed this argument in the conclusion of the book, is that whether it's enough to understand a one-off single policy success if our aim is transformation and if we're thinking about sustainability and transformation. So it's one thing to get a policy implemented, and I'm thinking a lot in the case in our book about the Uber in San Francisco as well as the three lines of BRT in Mexico City that took 12 years. So there were very successful tactics used to push these policies forward against all odds is the way I like to think of it, because it's very hard to kind of move in a sector where there's so much money and there's so many interests invested in old ways of offering transportation. But one of the things that I started wondering is whether we should look at all these eight cases, even if they all use the same tactics and they were all successful, with the same framework. And I would like to argue that we need to make a distinction between policy success and a long-term transformative capacity. And from my view, long-term transformative capacity is deeply embedded in governance capacity. And if a single policy does not enhance governance capacity, I question whether that really lays the groundwork for transformation. In particular, and this is the argument that I'll be making tomorrow night if I have an opportunity at the Greater London Council, that Uber was a behind-the-scenes small negotiation between the mayor and the private companies that developed IT technologies, starting with Uber and Lyft, etc. And in order, they had to first get a shift in the regulations in California, and the mayor knew that was going to be very difficult, but the mayor wanted to make the IT industry happy because he was selling the city as a haven for innovation, the innovation economy. And what he ended up doing was kicking upstairs to the state of California the regulatory changes so he didn't have to deal with the politics of changing regulation at the level of the city. Ultimately, the regulation was changed at the state level. Uber steps in the picture, and there was no discussion at all about what is the larger aim of changing mobility patterns in San Francisco. Where are we heading with this? What will it do for those of us who are trying to offer accessible, just, equitable transport in a city and to increase sustainability? As we all know, these days, when we were doing the case 4 years ago, these electronic, these IT ride sourcing, ride sharing have brought more cars on the street rather than less cars on the street. Nobody is thinking about the kind of larger governance priorities with respect to urban sustainability. So my last concept, or my last slide, I want us to move from tactical to strategic thinking, although earlier, Philip, we were talking about maybe strategic thinking comes first. In other words, where are you heading? It's not enough just to get something done. Is that policy that you are so successful in pushing, is that really going to help you down the road? Or might it cause a problem? In the case of Uber, for example, and if I would contrast that with congestion charging brought revenues to the city of Stockholm, as well as new institutional relationships at three levels of government, and they use those revenues to invest in new subway stations and in concentrated densification all over Sweden. So they have had a policy that was directly linked to a longer and a larger sustainability goal with multiple governance actors involved. In the California or the Uber case, that money goes directly into the pockets of the private sector, and that takes riders away from the public sector, and it reduces governance capacity to be able to have the finances to actually build a sustainable city. So that's the point, and we looked a little bit at, tried to understand what types of implementation processes, and maybe this is the last point, because I know in the work that Alejandro and others at our school in urban design, I've been looking a lot about participation and participatory design. So it's not just the design intervention, but what is the implementation process to get that intervention? We found in our cases that those with the most, I would say, contentious and long implementation with many stakeholders involved ultimately ended up enhancing governance capacity more than the ones that were rapidly done with small, not transparent conversations between a couple people with power and stakeholders. That really are not thinking about the long-term future, but only what they can get done in the moment. So that is where I'll end. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
And we also have a handbook with some of the stuff, too, if you're interested.
Thank you very much, Diane. I think it has become absolutely clear that if you are reflecting on tactics in the context of a policy like urban transport, you are very quickly ending up with issues like large scale, big, long term, and then also strategic. I think it's really part of the substantive engagement with this particular issue. There are a couple of points which then really, I think, illustrate how we need to talk in the end here also about quite top-down processes. Your study gave the stamp of approval of a healthy democracy because you refer to big things don't happen without the mayor. That's a good thing. That's how it should be, right? I mean, it would be awful if it was the other way around. I think you were talking about how you can ensure that your tactics don't end up as firefighting, just, you know, the next little bit problem you try to overcome, and therefore actually it may be ahead of starting to be more strategic again. And I think when we now shift to Alejandro, this question of scale and how the tactics is differently interpreted depending on the scale of the issue will be really an interesting question which should remain with us. Clearly in your case, I mean, strategy and tactics belong together. The sequences seems to be two ways, but they are a pair which we need to really bundle up properly. So I would like to move to Alejandro, coming from a different angle, with a different scale, but I'm sure equally inspiring.
I hope, Philip. So thank you, Philip. Thank you, Ricky, and the LSE for inviting me to share some ideas in this lecture. And I am very proud to be with you, Diane. I will talk about some of experience that belongs to the city, the process of the Medellin transformation, but not with about everything. It's some processes that I have a personal experience, and I was engaged when we were in the government and talk about some complementary things. So about tactics, I will touch some of the tactics, but I prefer, of course, we will have the opportunity to talk in the conversation with more detail and so on. So I will explain some of the ideas of the process of Medellin that has happened in the last 15 to 20 years. For some of you that doesn't know very well where we are, Medellin is under those clouds in a narrow valley, located in the center of Colombia, in the Andean Mountains. We have three corridors. So we are people that belongs to the mountains in some way in Medellin, and this is the logic as well, that the life of the city happens going up and going down in some way. And I must say that many things happens under the clouds, bad ones and good ones. I am talking about the good ones, but maybe in the conversation we could talk about the fragile things and the bad ones. So Colombia as well is located in the northern part of South America, and it converge the most exceptional ecosystems. It connects the Caribbean, the Pacific, the Andean Mountains, and the Amazon, making it an exceptional spot of global biodiversity. And we have a real differences in relation with the regions. I am talking about music, I am talking about food, I am talking about the behavior as well. At the same time, Colombia is a country of cities, because today we are close to the 78% of urbanization, yes. Thank you. And in the picture, you see this Medellin city. You see in the far of the image, there is the south of the city, where the middle classes and upper classes are located. The downtown, just in the center of the image, and on the left, this picture is belongs to the northeast slopes, the comunas on the east. And in the image, the teleférico, that is the cable car that belongs to an integrated system that connects with metro, BRT, and now we have a tramway as well. And this is an important part of the history of Medellin, of course. So Medellin has 2.4 million inhabitants and 3.5 million in the metropolitan area. 70% of the current housing stock has informal origin. It's not informal, but has informal origin. Medellin are two in one. From above, they see us, and from below, we see them. Medellin is one, but with a broken spirit. This is a sentence of the Fernando Vallejo, an important writer, but describe this extreme complex condition that the city has in some way. So during the 80s and 90s, we were the capital of the drugs cartels, and we still have a very deep problems of drugs today, differently. Because of that, we were living in 1991 in the most violent city on earth at that time. On the map, you see in brown tones the slopes of the north, the city that has informal origin, and in yellow, the formal city, the south. Two different realities. Our cities in Colombia, and a lot of the cities in the global south, has completely different realities and this spatial injustice. And the violence in our case increased dramatically this separation. So we have clear frontiers in Medellin and borders. And of course, this problem and the combination with inequality and violence in the 90s increased the crisis. And to understand the process of Medellin, you have to understand the crisis in some way. So, how to turn it around? I must say that we are in the process to solve the problems. I think we start the process, and we have good examples, but we need a long way to transform the reality of the city. So some of the ideas and that belongs to the last governments, I think one of the most important is to have the right questions. What is the priority? So this putting inequality first, and this necessity to cultivate a new civic imagination of encounter, of education and culture. And the cities needs a narrative, a common history in specific moments of time. The people is looking always for a common agreement that connects them emotionally and rationally. I'm not saying that is that thing happens in ideal form in Medellin, but the crisis in some way opened the space for a kind of consensus, not an ideal consensus, but a possible consensus with agreements. In our case, the crisis accelerated and put things together in some way. So I must say that I think today we need a new crisis in some way after the reality, that moment. So, but one thing that is very important, and if you see the small scale processes and projects, and I'm not going to talk in this with this image, but the processes are the key. If after 15 years or 20 years, if you put your eye in the most sustainable processes and programs, you understand that the process was very important. And this agenda that was open with many different actors from the beginning and how you design the process is one of the keys of that. So Medellin transformed municipal bureaucracy, bringing public design intelligence into city planning, but not only in the city planning. Invite a lot of different actors that have been engaged in the discussion before, that has some role in the political decisions and programs as well. Has the capacity to coordinate, be strategic, and this is the most difficult challenge. So in my personal experience, and after we were in the government, I realized today that we have a really special and exceptional moment. The necessity to coordinate these different structures that belongs to the municipality, and if you are thinking in integral projects, is really difficult. And politics doesn't help to do that. So these things needs a different dialogue, and it's possible, but it's difficult. It means that you need to transform traditional politicians and politics. And so sometimes you could do that, but it's difficult. Increase the capacity and push them to work together and to have some kind of continuity. The interventions and the built environment and the physical transformation that became the expression of public policies are very important. So public spaces and infrastructure of inclusion, intervening into urban borders, transforming into sites of knowledge and exchange. Because violence separates, exclusion separates, is about where to act, for whom, about the quality and the beauty, of course, but about the meaning and the strategic, those strategic new connections. And where to locate those programs and how they happen are very important in relation to give a possibility. So the public transport system became a very powerful tool. So I am not talking about a linear history, because the metro started to operate in Medellin in 1995. And the first cable car started to work maybe in 2004. But with the process, we learned that to use those public transport system and to put together another programs and policies and more holistic interventions around the stations could help a lot in this process. So this is the historical Comuna 13 in Medellin, when the Orion battle, Operación Orion, happens in 2002. We have like a war on the streets. We have helicopters that bomb the barrios and this comuna and so on. This is one of our historical borders. So one of the ideas was how to reconnect in some way. In the aerial view, you see on the left the informal Comuna 13, and on the right, the formal neighborhood of San Javier. The yellow line marks the border in some way. We still have a very big problems there. We located in the strategic yellow border the integration of the metro station with the teleférico going up the hill of the comuna. And the new library park on the side, the new public sport facilities close to the station, the new public school as well, like a confluence of a new public spaces and program. So in this border is a strategic to reconnect people, the social behavior in some way. So those programs belongs more to the municipal initiative, and the real challenge today is how those programs reconnect with the local initiatives and the cultural ones that still have some problems as well. So the converge, the idea of social urbanism looks for a converge of integral programs that combines infrastructure and social cohesion, education, culture, and innovation. On the map of the right are six strategic sites of intervention. The city develops them between 2004 and 2012. In the image of the left is the plan of the first urban integral project. Connect with the first corridor of the cable car, the integral system of mobility, and as well connect with the metro. We have today, from the last start to operate 2 years ago, the tramway as well. We have a new corridor that connects the metro, the tramway, a new cable car as well, and connect some strategic areas. Six strategic areas for integral interventions to be transformed in 8 years. We could say today that three of them could be developed following the plan. Not perfect, but following the plan. And the others are in process. In process is an idea, because the last government doesn't have the continuity of these integral interventions as well. So I must say that, like in Bogota, when Enrique Peñalosa and Antanas Mockus were the mayors as well, we learned a lot from them. The politicians and the mayors are the key in some way. In some specific moment to engage people to build confidence and to lead the discussions in some way. So this sketch belongs to Fajardo. He was the mayor with I have been working with him, and the simple idea of that moment and in his mind was to increase the door of opportunities and reduce the door of illegality, creating opportunities in the territory, in the public space, with new programs. In some way, was the answer to the problem of violence that our society has. This is the map of opportunities and where the different programs of the government in this strategic zone. So the strategy was to select some specific places. This image is a plan for 170,000 people, and that it was a combination of programs as well and some physical interventions and very tactical ones, because most of them are very small ones and middle scale interventions. And this was the first example in relation to use in some way the new cable car, the teleférico, that is connected with the metro, and we have three stations. The first station to the right is Andalusia station. The middle station in the mid part of the slope is the Popular station, and the upper part is the Santo Domingo station. But the idea was how you could develop a sequence of interventions with housing programs, with new bridge that connect with the station and recover the Rambla, and then how to solve some problems of informality in the housing. But it's completely impossible to think that you could transform all the fabric and all the difficulties that the people live and the housing and so on. So to be strategic and to select the intervention and to start the change, the psychology, but as well the life of the people is important in some way. So the most, the Medellin, I think the success of some cases of Medellin belongs to the possibility of combine big scale and mid scale projects with a dense agenda of small scales and interconnected projects that are belongs to the everyday life of the people. And this is a real is very important as well to open, because mid scale and small scale projects you could replicate and you could expand with different actors as well, but you can open the dialogues and conversation. So some of those projects belongs to urban design, architecture as well, but I must say that belongs to some dialogues and connections and have some success. In the case of Medellin, those small bridges means a lot, because 20 years ago, those creeks, Juan Bobo to the right and La Herrera to the left, were like the frontiers that belongs to different militias. So the people could cross from La Francia to Andalusia and goes to the cable car station and goes to the school and so on. So it happens in some places of Medellin. The challenge is how you could replicate in a bigger scale. This is the problem as well. But change the psychology in some way, change the possibility. And this is one thing, because I am saying that Medellin starts to change in some way. So, about talking about continuity, some of the previous examples I showed before belongs to the two governments. I was working with them, but I must say that the agenda, the social agenda in the bigger picture, in some way continue. This is a good example that belongs to the next mayor of Aníbal Gaviria, that was in 2012. And continue the narrative of innovation and social infrastructure, like the transformation of the network of more of 30 water reservoirs into beautiful cultural and community centers. So the city has, in the upper part of the hills, some tanks, reservoirs for water and so on, and used to be located in the periphery, but because the city grew, are located in the middle of the barrios. And this idea to use those infrastructural, like cultural centers and meeting points, was good. And the city started to develop the network as well. One of the best examples is the New North, the North Zone, the second strategic area. The Barrio Moravia in the 80s on the left was the municipal dump site. Today, on the right, the confluence of new spaces, Explora Science Museum, the public park of the Botanical Garden, the Carabobo Rambla. And during the year, some of the most beautiful moments happens here, like the book fair, when all the places are open and connect for all. So this idea of using, this is a this space has the metropolitan scale. On the right, you have the Botanical Garden. On the left, the new museum. This is the axis of Carabobo Street that link with the Moravia Barrio that used to be the old dump of the city. And some moments of in the year, we have this beautiful encounter in relation with the different people in the city. So the public space became in Medellin, I think, one of the big issues about to change the narrative and to change the fear in some way. Because the battles happens before in some way in the streets. So, is this transformation sustainable? We could talk about in the conversation. I think it's possible, but the continuity, because we are in politics, is always fragile. Every government wants to leave his signature. But I am optimistic. There is a continuity with the bigger narrative, the narrative of the infrastructure of inclusion in some way in Medellin. But if you go deeply, we don't have in many social and local programs we have discontinuity. And this is a huge issue working with communities, because the effort is big to produce confidence, and it's very easy to stop them. So this continuity is not easy, but the power of the communities are huge. So this transformation as well give them visibility, and they are very active in some way in the city. The spaces of the city are more transparent today, fluid and connected, and less invisible. The ecosystem is more robust, solid, and active. Today there are dynamics of collaboration and platforms as well, and platforms of that you find a lot of examples that connect public and private partnerships and local initiatives, and this is important. But our obsession in our center in Urbam, our Center for Urban and Environmental Studies and Social Studies, is to increase the people's capacity. So we have some special programs in our master programs and workshops and so on, trying to increase the local capacity and engage people, some leaders, to push them to be powerful and active, to connect them with resources and decision makers, and to engage them in the strategic initiatives. I strongly convinced today that there is no possibility for a sustainable transformation in Medellin without this local network of workers and initiatives that could link some bigger decisions and so on. So we, in our center, our work today is how we could help this communication and dialogues between locals and different actors as well. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Before we continue, can I just ask to have the light in the front so it's all a bit more comfortable? Thank you. So, Alejandro, you have offered not only a very insightful perspective on your city of Medellin and the actions and an interpretation of the actions in many instances you have been leading, but you have also allowed us to appreciate how you may interpret the tactics issue as a spatial person, and the issue of scale is absolutely central to that question. You also highlighted and mentioned a few times the role of mayors, but you then really essentially reinterpreted this idea of opportunity as partially also spatial opportunities for the people on the ground, and how you connect with them and using their intelligence in the city design process, I think, is another provocation of how in some ways to introduce a more tactical approach to the institutions of planning, allowing them to engage with very different types of thinking. But in the end, you also went back to these questions of narratives and what you called a new civic imagination, which needs to underpin all of this. And in some ways, you suggested that this may indeed be the element which can allow for then a more sustainable and long-term continuity of these actions, if we are able to trust these narratives and we have enough buy-in. Now, before opening this up, I want to offer each of you the opportunity to ask each other questions or come up with further commentary. So, Diane, why don't you go first, and then Alejandro.
Well, I don't think I have a question for you, but I'm very intrigued by your presentation and maybe a comment that can be for the audience as a whole. Building up a little bit on what Philip is saying, I mean, let me just first say that a lot of the things you mentioned, a new civic imagination, crisis, transforming the political bureaucracy, and you use the word transformation a lot, combining big and small projects, all these I could see where they could fall under some of the tactics that I was thinking about in my project. So I'm very happy to see that there could be at least there's an implicit dialogue between thinking about design intervention and political strategies. So that's the first thing. But the second, I was really drawn by the way, not just that you talked about the importance of replicating or expanding these experiments or these innovations over scale. My point was to expand them over time. So we've got these two ideas of kind of space and time. The second thing I would say for us to talk about, it seems to me, is the fact that you're focusing on inclusion and citizens, and I'm talking about governance. So I feel like there must be an you know, if there's a Venn diagram or something, we're together someplace in there, and the question becomes how do we... How important it is to bring those things, the space and time together, as well as citizens and governance. The last thing I would say, again, just more questions for everybody, is I didn't underscore, but I think it's important to underscore here after listening to you, Alejandro, the importance of thinking about space when you're dealing about transportation. So it's not like housing. It's a policy, it's a sector of intervention that only makes sense if you understand the system and how it connects over physical space. And that is very different, I think, than like concentrated interventions, although you are very clear that you want to connect them over space. So maybe I think we want to understand a little more about how do those different scales get connected over space, and maybe the design intervention can start small and go big, but with transportation, I actually think you have to be thinking big at the same time as you're thinking small, or whatever you do small isn't going to change the system and you're not going to advance transportation. Sorry, that was a little...
So I like when you present and say that if you want to change and to flip in relation with transport and public transport system, you have to have a bigger idea, a dream, or in some way a different objective in relation. Because I strongly believe that we are talking about histories. We are talking about narrative. When you talk about how to improve and change some conditions of cities, we are not talking about technical issues mainly. They became the tools in some way. So this idea that permit you to be close and emotionally connected with people, so it's very important the notion of, and the timing as well. So I am thinking today what happens maybe 12 years ago where the city start to develop a different agenda, and at that time was some kind of consensus about this necessity to encounter again. So the concerts, the public spaces, the transport systems in some way became this possibility to cross the city, to see each other and to encounter and so on. So if you have this bigger dream in some way, is easy to connect bigger infrastructure and small ones. So it's easy to connect bridges and sidewalks to cable cars in relation to the people because it's the itineraries that they use and so on. So it depends the government and so on. So if you want to develop a big moment, so the government has to be there. But most of the times happens in the wrong direction, only with very simple actions and looking infrastructure, and but how to increase the agenda of actors and partners. You have to think with a more innovative and creative way in relation to develop a more porosity in the process, and you need different scales and you need more more dialogues and different voices. Unfortunately, the politicians doesn't like that. And I think I strongly believe that we need to improve a lot our way that we discuss and how the dynamics happens in the regulations and so on, be more put more intelligence and common sense there. But You are in different mood, depends where the time where you are. Now, personally, I am more connected with the small scale, I must say, and I strongly believe in those processes and middle scale, and because we need a more sustainable process. And without the community and the people and the initiative, it's very difficult. So it's not enough. You need a combination of both. Yeah.
So we should open up in a moment, but I also wanted to offer a reflection on, you know, in some ways a slight preference on the one hand for the smaller scale and on the other hand, of course, the big transformative story, which I think links back also to the type of political systems we have in mind. And it's no surprise, I guess, if you know the sort of mayoral city politics in Colombia, we are seeing a massive swinging back and forth of agendas where the projects of the previous mayor are usually the first projects you want to kill off. Therefore, it's very hard at the big level, at the strategic level, think Transmilenio, but even some of the cable cars and the bibliotecas, to keep the momentum at that big scale. Whereas almost all cities, maybe with the exception of Mexico, in your case study, Diane, are profiting from a far greater consensus, which actually quite different mayors from across the political spectrum over several decades have been able to slowly but continuously move into what we may want to consider a more sustainable transport regime. And I think that macro political landscape, I think, is really important to consider. So we have a bit of time left. Let's open it up. If you raise your hands, I'll try to be as democratic as possible. And then we would like to hear who you are, where you're from, very briefly, and then a rather concise intervention. If it's a question, please tell us who it is aiming at. And let's start at the very back. If we can have the microphones, since this session is recorded.
My name is Yoni, I'm the director of planning for the city of Tirana in Albania. And I think the city, my question, trying to merge a bit both of these issues, I think that when we speak about Mexico, I heard this idea of having three BRTs in 12 years. I also heard about the work of Laboratorio para la Ciudad, which did a mapathon and mapped the whole informal network in 2 weeks. And we had a similar situation in Tirana. We had these informal vans which were fairly well, and when we switched to formal buses, ridership actually went down. It was less comfortable and less sort of easy to actually get those vans coming as close to you. So my question, I guess, to both of you is there a way to merge those two things together, looking at how the sharing economy in terms of Uber is becoming more and more consolidated? There's now companies owning cars and just hiring people to do the driving. Is there a chance to use this tech layer and connect it with the informal transportation layer in maybe combining and producing and doing something new, which is big, but which is also a bit different than the typical BRT or bus or tram?
Thank you. And then Mark, please.
My name is Mark, and I'm one of Philip's master students. I'm a designer of social transformation processes in Cape Town. I'm fascinated by this study, Diane, sort of trying through case studies to extract something like a magic formula that stands behind certain patterns. I apologize if that sounds malicious, but somehow I have a feeling behind those categories you identified, there is something that almost looks like a bit how to fascipulate in order to avoid the word manipulate a system into a particular anticipated state. Mm-hmm. So is tactics kind of how do we manipulate and try to bypass or most efficiently reach a state that a group, an elite of people anticipates to be the best one, even bypassing, I don't know, some participatory processes or so? Mm-hmm. Or is that an unjust judgment of the word tactics? Mm-hmm.
Thank you. So let's come back here, and Alejandro, if you want to start, please.
So I will start for the second question and then for the first. And so about the new possibilities of mobility, we need to find. I don't have the answer in relation with how could happen those new things of shared mobility and different platforms that could help. But for sure, if you talk about, for example, Medellin and some of the Global South cities, we need a combination of these different modes and in relation to connect some informal logics and information here with formal ones, and to increase the capillarity in the barrios and so on to explore new forms of mobility. And I think it's going to happen very fast. And but we cannot talk about only formal mobility. And I am not talking about informal. Informal is not a good word. But we have to be very creative in relation to explore. For example, I am wondering what is going to happen in those slopes where the cable car are, because the economy is growing, maybe in 15 years or 20 years. Now it's happening. A lot of people is buying motorcycles and cars. There is no space for that. There is no space for increase. The cable car has a lot of limitations too in relation with capacity. So you have to develop a different system of mobility in some way. And it's not possible to open big streets and so on. But the economy is going, the consolidation is going, the quality of life is going, and so on. So the mobility has to change in some way. So we have a challenge. In Medellin we have a very powerful institutions, maybe different from other parts of Colombia. So the Metro company, that is public, a public company, is in some way the key of how we could develop metro, tramway, cable cars, and integrated mobility, and we could think in other possibilities with them, and giving continuity as well. So, talking about the local and the government in relation with the processes, I believe that I told at the end of my talk that I am more connected with small and middle scale, but not because I don't believe in the bigger scale projects. I've been working in that. It's because in my experience in different cities, not only in Medellin, the continuity is very difficult. And you see a lot of bad experiences in relation to amazing projects that doesn't happen. And you see a lot of initiatives that belongs to the other logic that happens in some way. So I am not saying that one is ideal or the other is. I think you need, in some way, you need to mediator. In our cases where politics change, you need to have some different initiatives of agencies that belongs to public and private or academy in some way to keep the ideas going and to keep this partnership going. Maybe not perfect, but going as well. You need to create some platforms that could mediate in some way. And we have to think about it. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to start with the manipulation question because I think, you know, you went right to the jugular. I think it's a reasonable question. So, and I think I want to underscore that in our project, we're talking about democratic societies, which doesn't mean that they're all open and, you know, there are so many versions of democracy. But I guess, well, two things. Those were the cases we're looking at. We're also looking at leadership here. So I agree that there's always the kind of threat and the possibility of, like, top-down manipulation, people with the pinnacle of power pushing their agenda. I don't think in these cases we looked at were those instances, but I think your point is a really important one. So how would I respond to that? It seems to me that this is where the first question comes in, when the person who asked about the kind of relationship between governance and local inclusion. What I would say in the cases, actually almost all the cases to different degrees, but really all the cases, there was a lot of social mobilization The Green Party was and environmental movements were involved in many of the cases. So we're not just talking about an idea that comes from the top down and then a manipulation of taxes to get that done. Often, and again, in my point about enhanced governance capacity, the places where there was a back and forth between citizens taking their own agency and working with governments to push forward an agenda was the story that we were telling. So I'd like to think it wasn't about manipulation. And the greater the kind of governance capacity, the more there was a dialectic and interaction between the two. Can I just say really quickly that I didn't get a chance to do it much because I was rushing through everything, but for just to give an example, in the Paris case, because I realized the slides were just the same title without the details, but in the particular case of Paris, when I talked about the kind of crisis and the time I mentioned the general strike of 1995, first of all, there was an air pollution crisis. Well, no, that comes in 2000, but in the general strike, which is a big political strike about a lot of things in Paris, when the prime minister proposed welfare cuts that resulted in demonstrations in cities, transportation workers went on strike and paralyzed the public transportation system. As a consequence, citizens got mobilized about transportation and also about power and politics and who's making decisions about who spends money on what. As a consequence, a lot of the users turned to cycling and ride-sharing, providing their own transportation, and then that movement grew after the strike was settled. Then there was a pollution crisis in 2000. So there are a series of things. There's a dialectic and an exchange between citizens and governing authorities in the more successful cases. The one exception was the Uber, which was a quick, dirty behind-the-scenes. That was manipulation, possibly, in a democratic system. So I think we just have to be open, and we as planners or policymakers have to have our ethics out, and we have to respond. We need citizens, and we should be responding to citizens' demands, but that doesn't mean that we don't have some expertise and knowledge from other domains that we have to introduce into the picture. Yeah. Citizens themselves cannot plan entire transportation systems. So, and about the formal, informal, I would just quickly say, I won't talk too much, we can talk afterwards. I think that technology can be used in an important way. In the Mexico City case, I think they need more than three BRTs. I don't want them to fall back on IT to deal with jitneys because that's not going to solve the problem. So it's a kind of the balance. If you're thinking about the larger spatial project and the big system of transportation that advances densification and sustainability, you cannot just rely on IT to work with private jitney owners. It's just not, it's not going to happen.
So I would like to add something, but so so I must say too that for example, you cannot think in the history of the Medellin transformation without the bigger picture in relation with the public transport system and the metro history that links in some way with many other policies in Medellin. So this idea of the big projects in relation with the metro institution and capacity that create a network of cable cars and teleféricos and then connect with tramways in some way and change the history of Medellin in some way. Mm-hmm. Not completely, but it's very important tool of that. So the community is not going to do that. So, but the question is how you could use this logic and increase the transformation and connect with locals, giving another agenda in relation with itineraries and programs and different conversations and local economy and so on. But of course, the public transport system and the network is the key in our case.
Yeah. Great, thank you. I mean, this last point also reminded me of what Julio Davila, and you may want to talk in a moment, what in your excellent research, it was suggested that the expenditure related to the cable car was in sometimes, I think, then multiplied 9 times for the social infrastructures that were built around these opportunities of access. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, although, yes, these are smaller grain interventions, but there are many, many, many of them. And all of a sudden, this small stuff, this sort of these urban interventions, the acupuncture, actually has a scaling effect, which is enormous, and also is displayed in the budget. So let's have another round. I think, Ryan, you had your hand up, and then let's move slowly to the front. The microphone here in the center, Actually, I'll do this cluster of three. Only men, and then we have only women, I think. Please. Ryan.
Hi, I'm Ryan Sandra. I'm an assistant professor of urban geography here at LSE, Department of Urban Environment. My question is about innovation, which some of you now both talked about it in your presentations, and you both touched on it in your responses to the first round of questions, and that is, where is the innovation? How are we differentiating between innovation in government or governance, innovation in the specific urban amenities, and innovation in the provision of some kind of connectivity? Are these just all related to each other, or is there some difference, some prioritization in what kind of innovation is most important?
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ryan. If you could just give the mic back to the person behind you. Thanks.
Hi. Yes, I am Balmore. I'm from Caracas, Venezuela, and I'm particularly interested in the work on Medellin. And I'm an urban designer and architect also, and one of my main interests is to know how actually this process started. What was the main catalyst of this urban intervention, especially in a city with the conditions of informal settlements and informal urban areas? And also, who was actually financing all this work? How was the strategy behind it?
Thank you. And then two to the front. If you just pass the microphone to the front. Thank you.
Yes, thanks. I'm Oren Yiftachel from Be'er Sheva in Israel, and here on sabbatical for a year. My question mainly for Diane, but also for Alessandro. You talked about the importance of the merit, and I want to perhaps suggest that the ups and downs in politics quite often run against some of the professional logic that we know, at least with some approximation, what is a good city. And in that respect, we are really at a watershed point, and the little side story that you had about Uber is a huge story, because that is a privatization and perhaps monopoly of a future transport that could actually upset urban structure to a great degree, including just around the corner the autonomous car that could just multiply it. So what is a professional space against these changes that threaten? Perhaps it could be public Uber, perhaps it could be free public transport like in Tallinn, Estonia. What is the thinking in the eight cities to create what we know are good principles of an accessible and integrative city vis-a-vis of changes that just around the corner?
Thank you very much. Now, I will run 15 minutes over because we started late. But if you have to leave, just do so quietly. We will not be offended. But we'll continue here. Please.
I won't pick up the urban design question, which was for Alejandro, but I would underscore that in all of the cases we looked at, how you pulled together a financing strategy was absolutely central, and it's done in a different way depending on the innovation, but that's another set of things. I mean, maybe the first, Ryan and Oren's questions, I'm going to try to pile them together a little bit, because Ryan, you asked about, like, innovation, kind of begging the question of what is an innovation, and I want to say that in our project, it was a big source of debate and disagreement and argument in our steering committee. Because, for example, we did BRT, we studied BRT, not an innovation. I mean, like, I can't, how many years have we been talking about BRTs? Not at all an innovation, but we were interested in the deep case study story, so it was helpful to go to a place like Mexico City where we knew exactly the politics of it. So I want to first, as a disclaimer, who would agree on innovation in our book? What would qualify as innovation? Probably the only thing would be Uber. And we kind of backed into that. I didn't even want to study that because I hate Uber. I hated Uber back then. I didn't want to study it. I'm glad I didn't let my politics get in the way, because it was really important that we studied it. So, I mean, I think that's why in my presentation, I said we kind of looked at kind of innovations or changes in transport that experts around the world thought were important, like congestion charging. And here in London, you were like the first ones. We didn't study London because it's been studied. We went to Stockholm, etc. So there was some consensus in the transportation field at the time we started this project about what really pushing back, pushing the envelope, etc. we backed into studying Uber, and that's totally transformed the world of what we understand to be an innovation. As we were saying when we were together in Vienna, when we started this project 5 years ago, and where we are now, are talk about liquid modernity, we are in a very different place. And the answer to your question, Oren, about like what do we do with that and how do we govern that and what are the role of mayors, it's an open question. And I actually think that is the challenge for us now. Not to say that we can't still be thinking about BRT and heavy rail and cable cars and all sorts of other things, but the major challenge at hand is the disruption of the private sector entering into a domain that historically has been in the public sector, in part because the private sector could never would never pay for what needed to be paid for. They always wanted the government to pay for heavy rail, etc. So there's a larger political, it's not just a transport battle, it's about what is the balance of the public and private sector innovations in and situating those in space. So I don't have an answer to you, but I think that we have to be looking at it really quickly because the train is, sorry for the metaphor, but the train is out of the station. And in fact, even when Uber started, it was grabbed up immediately. Now, heavy rail, Deutsche Bahn, everybody is into information technology. Nobody is actually thinking about the physicality of the city anymore. They're just thinking about the modes and how to make the money on the modes running around. So if we take your admonition seriously, how do we think about network connectivity socially and spatially in cities? That requires a governance capacity. But how we're going to do that against this kind of innovation breathing down the necks of the public sector, I don't know, and that's what has to be figured out.
So talking about, I don't know if in our case we could say about innovation, but some things were new for us. And most of them happens in the shadows that are not visible. And because how the institutional capacity could put together initiatives in relation to engage government and private and some local leaders or initiatives. So I am not going to explain in detail, but each project in our case has different histories. Some of them start in communities like the Moravia Cultural Center and then have the support of the government and then engage a private foundation. And this relation happens in relation to how the process continues and so on. So the botanical garden has different history as well. So this combination of trust so happens because there are some space of trust in relation with government, private and community. Not ideal, but some kind of trust. So that you need this kind of confidence. Of course, and we could talk not now, but how to produce that. That is very difficult. So the other new thing for us was the possibility to develop holistic processes and how to coordinate the government and at the same time the different actors. So you need to innovate in relation how to agency those processes and how to articulate them. So in our case, we have some kind of agency that we call EDU, was like an institution that was not has some kind of autonomy, and the government decided to locate there the strategic projects and with a specific manager for each space or territory and with a specific team on site as well with visibility with face. So the face is very important because you do agreements. It's not the government; it's a person that do the agreements and how to those processes. You build the possibility that your agreement with the community goes fast to the mayor and then produce the change. And after 2 months, you have the compromise doing. So. This is important. So, at the same time, this idea of tactical interventions that permit to create dialogues with community in some way, not that the community decide everything. Keep open the dialogue in some way and enrich the possibilities. So, and we could call that the teleferic and cable car is an innovation because, but for me the most important innovation was that it happens in different scales and so on. So talking about how the process starts, the process, you cannot say that it starts in 1 year or belongs to one person. It starts in our case because the profound crisis that we have opened the space for intellectuals. We have films that express the life in the barrios in some way. We have very testimonies and very beautiful novels. And for example, I was talking this morning that there is a book in the 94 that No Nacimos Pa Semilla that permit us, and when we were at the university, and the people to understand some voices and so on. So we have TV programs in the most complex time that in the regional channel that opened the voice for the leaders, and those processes start to create some good initiatives, but not together. So the change came and accelerates with the politicians' change in some way, and engage some of the, those people and initiatives and work together and so on. So you can say, so in this year happens this political change, and in this year happens that change, but it was a process in some way. But unfortunately, we have to talk about the crisis helps. is real. And the finance. So the constitution in Colombia changed in 1991. And give more capacity to some governments and capacity in relation with regulations and finance as well. I must say that Medellin is the second city in Colombia, but is very strong of, in the economy. Even in the time where we were fighting against Pablo Escobar, the industry continues, all the economy continues in some way. But the city increased a lot the efficiency and the transparency, how they manage the public investment and contract and so on. It's very efficient. One in the national level, one for many years, the number one in relation with transparency and so on. But I must say that two things. One is a political decision, because the mayors decide in some way to change the budget that belongs to the bigger infrastructure, bridges and highways and so on, and to move the budget to library parks, schools, and so on. So with one big infrastructure, I don't know how many schools you could build, but this SWIFT helped a lot in the agenda. And I must say that we have an exceptional condition in Medellin too, because Medellin owns the company that owns the electricity and the water supply and the gas as well. Used to own the telecommunications, not only in Medellin, in Colombia. And it's an example in Latin America of a public company. So the profits of this company are huge and belongs to the municipality of Medellin. And so the 30% of the profits every year goes to the investment. So if you compare the investment of Medellin to Cali, two cities that are close to the same level, maybe Medellin is twice of the budget. And this company. That company has, you know, Philip, has difficult moments today because the Hidroituango debate. But you cannot talk about the transformation of Medellin without the EPM. And it's a public company. Yeah.
Thank you. Now, very unfortunate. I was about to ask, okay, who has a final really innovative, interesting question? But if you do have it, we have to do it outside. I need to bring this to a close. I will not summarize this, but I have two questions for our panelists. And the first is to Alejandro. And it's very much in the context of my colleague Gareth Jones last week convened a really exciting meeting with Daniel Quintero, hopefully a person we'll hear more about because he's running for mayor in Medellin. and that's going to happen, or the election is going to be in October. And I just wondered, with your fantastic experience in taking the tactics ideas, putting them forward, what's the one thing, the one piece of advice you would have for him? And then, Diane, similar question to you. Tomorrow evening we are going to meet sort of the GLA, that's the Greater London Authority Intelligentsia, working for the mayor to deliver a very ambitious target on further shifting the transport shares of the car, of vehicular traffic in London towards walking, cycling and public transport. What's your big advice to really achieve this quite revolutionary target? Alejandro.
So, you are Daniel?
I'm Daniel.
No, it's not. So, one thing that worry me a lot today is because the success, not the success, but if you think the Medellin is the most innovative city, that is not true in the world, but we have we did and we are doing many different things. This international visibility and this role change the priorities of many of the new people in Medellin and the agenda too. So the actual mayor and I think in the debate that we are going to have, this agenda that belongs to international discussions about pollution, about clean mobility and so on, are okay. But in our case, the real innovation will be if you connect those agendas with social inclusion. And you cannot lose this priority because the challenge of the city is there in some way. So, and it's not difficult to connect them. But it's very difficult, the debate, because it's not trendy. It's not, how do you say?
Fashionable.
It's not fashionable. And so the powerful today in Medellin and the very active leaders that belongs to the barrios are amazing. The process of Medellin increased the capacity and the visibility and the dialogue. So put intelligence and trying to connect public policies with those initiatives will be very powerful.
Thank you. Diane, sorry for putting you on the
yes,
spot.
Yes, really. So if I give you an answer to that question, then Mayor Khan won't ask me to be a consultant for him, so I would say this in public. No, seriously, I would suggest that we think a lot about the work that Alejandro has done in Medellin under the concept of social urbanism. So what I would suggest needs to happen is the big imagination, the big idea that you've mentioned in your presentation that I'm totally aligned with, this sense of what should people in London be thinking about under the rubric of social urbanism, not framing it in terms of carbon emissions or transit or goals, under this alternate framing, what is the city that Londoners want to live in? What does it look like at the level of the street, pedestrians, connectivity, etc.? What does it look like in their everyday life? Are they going to be commuting out very far? How are they going to live in this city? And then how should the policies be engineered back to create that city? As opposed to thinking about these goals and technology and then, you know, then they're just moving things forward without having a sense of the big picture. So.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Thanks to our speakers.